This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2017, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 4.
So, foundation and basis for authority. 3 weeks ago, I was in a court of law as a spectator with my son, Shannon. Before us was a question of a little girl who had been a foster child of theirs, a little prison baby that they took care of. 9 years have gone by, and we were in that court of law to decide this little girl's fate. And I'll just never forget the feel. So here we are in the audience. Oh, back up there in one of the boxes, one of the witness boxes, was an ex-boyfriend. Not the father, but an ex-boyfriend. Dad is in prison. Over here is the lesbian wife in the audience. Up there's the judge. And over here is a couple lawyers for CYS, Children and Youth Services. And a couple lawyers over here. My wife was there, but she was outside of the courtroom. They had forgotten to get somebody to take care of these children while this court proceeding takes place. Halfway through that proceeding, it occurred to me, who in the world has the right to decide this girl's fate? Foundation and basis for authority. It's a huge question. It's a huge question. And I would say, honestly, the crisis that I see facing both our churches and Western civilization is this question and what we are actually going to do with it. Now, you see the four subjects that I will be addressing along these lines in these next couple of days. We're not in a courtroom. In fact, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. I doubt I really need to convince you of who's in charge. I doubt that. I realize that. But you realize that you are probably among less than 5% of the world's population anymore, particularly in Western civilization, that would buy into and even listen to me in terms of what I'm going to say to you in the next half an hour. They would just write it off because they have a totally different perspective. In that courtroom that I just got done mentioning to you, you know, one after another, that people go up. Would you raise your hand and swear or affirm that you're going to tell the truth and nothing but the truth? And my wife reported to me that while she was out there in that little room, Jaina and Nevaeh are talking to each other. And they said, they were jabbering like little girls do. And they said, yeah, you know what they say to you? They tell you to raise your hand. And when you raise your hand, then you're supposed to say, I swear that I'm going to tell the truth. What in the world are those little girls thinking? What is their perspective of this? Foundation and basis of authority. But looking here just a little bit before I move on to make sure you get the feel here. So this first session is kind of going to be theoretical, a little theory, a little philosophy, a little look at it. Well, so, and again, I suspect that you're not going to disagree with me on anything, but most of the world would. Tomorrow, developing personal authority, and probably for most of us, that really is a real question. You are a teacher, right? And everybody wants to have influence. Everybody wants to have, I wouldn't say authority, maybe. That word is kind of nuanced and all that, but We want to be able to walk into the classroom and actually be in charge. And I know that's what you're here for, to hear that. Probably not the theory, but we'll start in on that. Partnering with community authority is third, and then authority in action, particularly the last one there. So what actually happens in the classroom? One of the reasons I'm taking a little time here to look at this, I would be very happy if you would just push some questions my direction, particularly for the last one there, authority in action. So what do you face in the classroom? What is it that you actually come up against? So you can spin all the theory you want. Theology and theory, the words are too close to each other. They start out the same. So there's theology, there's theory, there's reality, and then there's felt reality. And here's the interesting thing. When you walk through that classroom door on the first day of school and on the last day of school, what really is in your face is the felt reality. What does it feel like to be there? So when all of the theology and theories are out of the way, and when you put your finger on what you think is reality, there still is felt reality. And you have to deal with that. So you'll hear me talking about those pieces as we go along here. And I want to be clear. I know that at the end of the day and at the end of these sessions, those are the pieces you want. What do I do with that felt reality? When that child says, no, I'm not doing that. Or that parent says, you're off the wall. Then what do? Okay, if you've got questions along that line, go ahead and push them my direction. And we'll talk about them. We probably won't answer them, but we'll talk about them. And there's some other people here who could do very well with that as well. But for this morning, foundation and basis for authority. I've been saying for quite some time now to my students here that there are four questions that really need to be answered desperately. The first one, who is Christ? You may question, well, yeah, okay, well, I know that. But you realize that in Christian history, this has been a huge question. Who is he? And many, many, many heresies surround this question. Second, what is the church? Third, who are its members? And I've highlighted the fourth one because in some ways, it's the question really that we're confronted with. Well, who in the world says so anyway? Who says so? Who has the authority to actually say it? And it feels to me as though in our generation, we've learned to question things way more than we used to. We actually made a little change here, but at Faith Builders, no insults to any students here, but for a little while, when I'd be teaching world history, they'd be back there tapping away on their computers. I think we made sure now that they can't access the internet while they're in classroom, but at that time they could, and so they would, and all of a sudden I would say such and such a date, and somebody would raise their hand and say, well, no, that was 1875, not 1873, or whatever. Oh, okay. Who has the authority to say so? You know, they're finding information over here and here and here and everywhere else, and there's all kinds of stuff. You can prove almost anything off of the internet these days. Question is, who says so? Huge question. And just all across the board, in our churches, it's a valid question. Who says so? Who actually calls the shot at the end of the day? Well, I'm going to take a look at a couple of passages here. Jesus was interested in this question and was confronted with it. I don't want to unpack this entire passage here, but just a quick look at it. When he was come into the temple, the chief priest and the elders of the people came unto him as he was teaching and asked the question I just gave to you. By what authority doest thou these things? And who gave thee this authority? And of course, you already know how this was answered, but Jesus said, well, I'll ask you a thing, you tell me. The baptism of John, whence was it? From heaven or of men? And they reasoned with themselves, saying, well, if we say from heaven, he will say unto us, well, why didn't you then believe him? Follow through. But if we shall say of men, well, we fear the people. I want you to note that phrase. So if we say of God, where authority finally rests, well, then why do you believe him? If we say of men, well, we fear the people. Very, very interesting phrase there. Jesus speaks again. Then said Pilate unto him, speakest thou not unto me? You know the context here. Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee? Jesus answered, thou couldest have no power at all against me except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath a greater sin. Main phrase here is Jesus' assertion that all authority ultimately rests in God, in the sovereignty of God. Now, I already told you I'm preaching to the choir, and I'll bet you agree with me. But I would suppose that there are times when it gets a little bit not so sure. And I'll demonstrate that here after a bit. But I'm fully persuaded it's right. Jesus said, you couldn't do a thing unless it was given you of God. Think Donald Trump. Think Adolf Hitler. Think Joseph Stalin. Think all of these people. You could not do a thing except it was given you from above, except you were given that authority. Very, very, very fascinating. Again, I know we all start there, but remember, there is a theory, there is a reality, and then there is a felt reality. Come back to my courtroom scene, just to get this point. Anybody knows that this little girl belongs in a healthy home somewhere where she just has a chance. If there's a God in heaven, surely he would see to it, not... Well, what if he doesn't? Is that judge still there? And is he still been given that power by God? Is it rooted there? Do I still say, you couldn't do anything except it were given you from above? Wrestle with that question of theory, reality, felt reality. It's quite a question. Jesus speaks again. Then spake Jesus to the multitude, this is in Matthew, and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do, but do not ye after their works, for they say, and do not. And again, the highlighted words here, sit in Moses' seat. One of the big challenges today is a positional authority is typically downplayed. In fact, people want to say, well, it's more about the person than it is about the position. There's truth to that. There's some truth to that, but we have disregarded position too much. You see what Jesus said here. He said, they are in the position to tell you so. They sit in Moses' seat. You listen to them. You know, and there's an interesting question in church history that came up. So what if you were married by a person who was living in adultery? So they had the position as priest to actually do the marrying, right? So they marry you. Later on, 3 years later, it's found out that all the time they were a child molester. Even before they married you and all of that. Does that disannul your marriage? Well, you can see the havoc that this would create if what you do is you, for every position... position of authority, you require that the character of the person makes the position. This is clear. It's not the case. Position is position. And in our world today, we're having a problem here, particularly in the church and other places like that. We've learned to kind of disrespect position. And I just warn us that we have to turn away from that. Jesus said, they sit in Moses' seat and you listen to them. Don't do as they do, but you listen to them. And it's something that we need to hear. Oh, I might say before I go to the next point, my dad used to say that off and on. When one of we children would say, well, why? We'd say, because I'm your dad. Now, today's generation, would, particularly outside of the church, would never want to hear that. But he was right. If there's any natural authority position in the world, it surely is a dad. And if you think about it now, if we're going to disregard that position, we've got problems. Jesus speaks again. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. I've been in a number of discussions over the authority of the word of the Lord, and even in conservative Mennonite circles, I'm questioning about this, that, and the other thing. And I always come back to this and say, look, if Jesus, if we really accept him as the ultimate authority and what he says holds, even where we don't, where we have some, if we have a question, we're quibbling over this or that. Question is, what did Jesus say? Well, what did he say about the word of the Lord? It's a pretty strong statement here. He gave it strong credence. I don't think you can find anywhere in Jesus' teaching where he suggests that you can kind of just disregard the word. He did say, even in this passage, he's saying, I came to fulfill. But he made it very clear there's not one, not even a crossing of the T or a dotting of the I or any such thing that is going to pass away from the law until all is fulfilled and it's clear that it's been fulfilled. Well, if he held that kind of opinion of the Bible, the word of the Lord, so should we. Now, I know he didn't have the Bible as we have it today, but the scriptures that he held in his hands, that was his view. Again, I feel very much like I'm preaching to the choir. But I'll never forget a high school scene. I went to public high schools. And mind you, my world cultures teacher in about 11th grade or something like that had us have a debate as to whether the Jewish people should have the land of Israel or not. This was a pagan secular teacher, and of course we were studying history, and so we wanted to have this debate. And don't you know, I was chosen to lead the one team. And mind you, I was pro-Israel, sure. But I don't know if I was or not. But anyway, that was a sign I was given. And I'll never forget, there was a fellow by the name of John. John was on my team, and John was passionate and kind of from the fundamentalist camp and so on. Yeah, so we got into the debate, and you know, he stood up and he said, well, the Bible says. And you can expect what happened. The teacher stood up and said, so? What if it does? What's that proof? Listen, I'm telling you, look at this group of people here, and I'm going to guess very close to 100%, if not 100%, in this room would not question my comment in saying, well, if the Bible says so, it needs to be taken seriously. But again, I point out to you, in the broader culture, clearly that's not the case at all. Now, here's a point that we need to get. Culture has a way of just soaking in. Even if you still hold theoretically to the position that the Bible is final authority and the Bible, well, I believe the Bible, it is true, still that it has a way of just working at you and just kind of seeping in. So I think it's a point that we should keep working at. And Jesus himself, I'm going to use this passage later on, perhaps tomorrow or one of the sessions, I'm not sure which one yet. You'll recognize the passage from Philippians chapter 2. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore, for this reason, God also hath highly exalted him. Now, I'm not going to look at the reasons there. You already know them, but they're listed. And he was given tremendous authority. You can read the rest of the passage. I just should read it because it's so strong. And given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow, things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Again, I want you to consider my little model here of theory, reality, and felt reality. But now just put yourself into the Holocaust, and you're a Jewish family, and your dad has just been marched off to the gas chambers, and your mother is incarcerated over here, and she's likely headed that direction. Three of your siblings have already gone there, and somebody reads this passage to you and says, "Wow, Jesus is Lord, and he's in ultimate control, and no power is given to anybody except it comes from..." Do you see how easily you're tempted to say, "Really? Honestly, then how in the world is this going on? Pray tell if he's in charge." Not say more about it now, but actually the main point here is the foundation and basis of Jesus' authority is laid out just in a really nice form in the book of Philippians, and gives us a model which we'll look at later. Now, I'd like to unpack the question of who says so just a little bit more. Because, again, where the rubber hits the road, you could raise the question, who says so? But what are the mechanisms? What are the sub-questions that actually get at the core of that question of who says so? First, where is the seat and source of authority? And I'll come back to that when I'm going to talk about a couple of these questions, not all of them. We'll just let them stand for now. But where's the source? Where's the seat? Second, how is authority validated in a given culture? Who do we hand authority to, and how do we validate it to say that they really have been invested with this authority? What are the means, methods, and enforcement of authority? A rule is never a rule. A law is never a law unless it can be enforced and is enforced. Okay, so these questions are really relatively complex when you get right down to it. They're not just simple ones. Fourth, what is the role of culture in a generation's attitude formation? Now, I am calling it attitude formation. Attitudes are formed, they're shaped in respect to authority structures. Culture weighs on us. Our own culture says much, speaks into this. And finally there, what difference does it make? Or who cares, and why should I care? I added this question just recently because of the Jaina story. It was like, well, who cares? And after the discussion, I said, well, so what? Who cares? Well, we ought to care. We ought to care deeply. But maybe I'll say more about that one later on if we have time. Not this morning, but on another day. So where's the seat of authority? I want to talk about this one just a little bit because it's a big question. All right, already said that probably in this room, most of us would agree that the sovereign role of God is where we find the ultimate source of authority. So I won't take long to argue that point. That's where the bishop gets his authority. That's where parents get their authority. That's where government, Romans chapter 13. Probably nobody wants to argue with me yet. I put Stalin on here just so that, and I made it a dashed line, because we might not have problems going along here, but when we bump into some questions, particularly if you begin to feel the heat of authority that is abusive, and whatever, it can be a dad, it can be a ruler like this, or who knows, a church leader, whatever. When you are that person, I promise you the question of where does ultimate authority actually lie will come up. I guarantee this yours can be. King. So we could talk about King David. How did he become a king anyway? Well, you know the story. It's a fascinating story. It's an interplay between the people and a prophet and God. And did God actually ordain him, or did he just allow the people to do that? Some tough questions there. Not the opposite, but in contrast to that is is what I call a demokratia. These are the Greek words that the word democracy comes from, actually. And literally means people power. Now, listen to me carefully here. It's not that our pagan world does not believe in authority. Yes, they do. What do you think a prison is about? What do you think the military is about? What do you think policemen are about? Of course they do. But the seat of authority in the mind of the rank and file pagan is certainly not in the sovereignty of God. And in the culture we live in, it is in the power of the people. It's a very fascinating thing. Sorry to put this one up here, but I'll have to put it up here. So why is he considered a valid president of the United States? I'm not going to talk about his character. I'm not going to talk about any of that. Just it's the people voted for him. And so you and I sit here under President Trump because of the power of the people who voted that direction. That's the way a democracy works. There's a subtle thing here that you need to pay attention to. We talk about the democratization of the church. Here's one to consider. Because what it does is it creates an alternate seat of authority, if you're not careful. Okay? And when it does that, you have made a shift. You have made a pretty significant shift. You did not hear me say that congregations should not participate in the life of the church. That is not my point. Don't go away from here hearing me say that. What you are hearing me say is the democratization of the church holds the potential to shift the seat of authority pretty significantly. And hence, I look at it with some caution and raise the question, so what's shifting here as you decide to do this or do that or do the other thing? And I'll talk about that just a little bit more here in a moment. In church offices, we often vote on. You did not hear me say I have a problem with that. Okay, but notice what the deal is. And sometimes a bishop is actually installed by the vote. Okay, I know I'm on thin ice here. And teachers maybe don't even care about this, but I do. And so does Howard. And so does a couple of other church leaders here. We do care about how this actually works. Mennonites have done a very interesting thing to kind of wed these two. Because you know what we do? We nominate for our leaders. Do you see how that's the power of the people? Okay, so that's it. So Sam nominates Bill and Bill nominates Paul, or however this all works, you know. And so we do this nominating process. And of course, there are various ways in which that's worked out, which can in some ways either deepen demokratia or it can lighten it, depending on how that nomination is done. Okay, so the nomination process happens, and then we cast lots, and God decides. And do you see how that shifts it over toward the green side here, toward the sovereignty of God? It says, "Now let God decide." I can still hear the old bishop say, "We've prayed and we've nominated, we've done our work, and now it's time for God to say so." Didn't quite use those words, but it was kind of along that line. Fascinating movement here. And for those of you interested in this, my point here is that we are finding ourselves in a dance between these two in various ways. And depending on just a little bit where we're at, we end up really having a seat of authority that is people-based and not God-based. That's something we just need to consider. Again, I emphasize, you're not hearing me say that we do not want full congregational commitment and participation in the work of the church. That's not the point. But how do we validate? How do we make sure that so-and-so actually has been called of God? Just talked to a brother yesterday who said to me, you know, when I was ordained as a minister, there was nobody else in the lot. I was the only one named and I was ordained. Now, you would think that would give you confidence. this brother said, it actually undercut my confidence. I wasn't quite sure if it was just the people who made up their mind on this, or if God himself had actually called me this way. Well, I'd let that be to that brother and to his church. But I was at a bishop ordination one time that was very fascinating. When the books were set, mind you, just to give you an idea of how we see things, the lot had slipped out of the book and was showing. The presiding bishop didn't see it, and just kept right on going. One of the people in the lot saw it. Well, I think they all saw it, actually. And in the church that I grew up in, it was kind of traditional that you sat eldest to the youngest, you know, on the front seat there or whatever. And then the books were lined, and normally the eldest got up and took the first book, and they went right down the line. Well, this one was the end book. So, like, it was already decided, right? One of the brothers actually thought he had seen a vision. His testimony afterwards, I just assumed it was a vision because I couldn't imagine that the thing would be sticking out. Well, the first brother, the first two or three, I don't remember how many there were, who were going to take books, were they going to get up and take the book that had that slip sticking out? Well, of course not. I have a question for you. The sovereignty of God and the validity of that ordination. The whole thing went through. The man was ordained, laid hands on it. Afterwards, another person said to the presiding bishop, "Did you know?" And he said, "No, I didn't know." And then he said, "But look, we've ordained the brother now. You can't undo it. That's done." You know, I was just a 20-year-old or something like that, and I remember being so astounded, and pondering the questions that all of this threw right onto the floor. So is this really a valid ordination? Now, you might guess that brother, that plagued him all the way down through his years of being a bishop. Just a little bit. I was happy that most of the congregations that were involved were mature enough to accept it. Why? Well, let me just go ahead here just a step. I put a dashed line because we resolve this, don't we? Put a dashed line from the sovereignty of God over to Demas Gratia, because do you believe that God could work through the American electorate to actually elect the president that he wanted to see put in place? I think that's probably what you would say, not? I do. And so that's how we find some resolution here. We just simply say, well, there is this thing of Demas Gratia or people power and so on. But God uses that to accomplish his purposes. And I agree. I still will say that, remember the cultural attitude. So the cultural attitude you have is that, in fact, God sovereignly worked through the electorate to bring this to pass. What about the pagan? We elected him. And if we elected him, and that's, if we want to throw him out, we'll throw him out, and we'll do this, or we'll do that, or we'll do the other thing. People power. And incidentally, I don't have a phone on me, and that's a good thing. But if you have one of those phones, and they do this, and they do that, that has increased people power incredibly. Have you thought about what's happened with that thing? Clearly, the Egyptian riots here just, 5, 6, 7 years ago, they were called together via Twitter. They were able to round up and bring together tens of thousands of people in the cities of Egypt because they had equipment that would do it. Why are policemen being called into account like you wouldn't believe? Nobody knows who took a video of what happened and what angle it was taken from and how it's actually going to be shown. It's dramatically increased. Demos Gratia, people power. Okay, I told you this is theory, a little bit philosophical, I know, but I'm telling you it is affecting us. It has its way of actually touching us. And I'm saying in our churches and other places, this whole thing is working itself out, and it's one of the reasons that you find more issues in the classroom, say now, than what you would have maybe 20, 25 years ago. Couldn't help but raise the question, teacher, so who's validated you? I heard a brother this morning say called. You've been called. Where are you at here, Howard? Oh, you were back there. You've been called. How's that validated? I'm not going to get into that, but I suspect that most of us have at one time or another wandered. So why am I here? And why am I doing what am I doing? And who says so anyway? Why is it this way? Really great questions. I'm not going to answer it for you, except I can say with, I think, a fair amount of confidence that I agree with those who say, look, if God moved through the red line there, the people, your leaders and so forth, to call you into a place of teaching, well, step in there and do it. I'll let it lay at that. Need to go on. Now, keep trying to emphasize here, there is theory, there is reality, and there's felt reality. Well, one of the places where I think about this an awful lot is in the little statement, Jesus is Lord. I have pondered this question as a church leader many, and as just personally, many, many, many times. Anybody could say that Jesus is Lord. And when I'm talking to students about this, I draw a cross, and then I draw a globe, and then I say, okay, so Jesus is Lord. He's the exalted Lord. How in the world is that lordship exercised on the face of the earth? And to be more specific, how is it exercised in the body of Christ? So how is it that he's Lord? And more than that, how is he actually Lord of my life? Is it just me finding his commands and trying to obey them? Is that what makes him Lord? Or what? Just exactly how is that lordship expressed? How is it actually felt? And remember, theory, reality, felt reality. What's the felt reality there in particular? Well, you see here a chain of command, or a very simple flowchart, authority flowchart. Because now leaving the question of Jesus as Lord and just thinking about the reality. What is the reality? You know what the for the teacher? The right question to ask is, who is my boss? Who do I actually answer to anyway? And so going all the way now from just that kind of theoretical stuff about Demas Cotia and all that, and asking myself the question, so what about me? Where's my seat of authority? Well, so if you're a faculty member, you find your way back up through a flow chart, and who's my immediate boss? And if you're into organizations, institutional and business and all of that, this all makes perfect sense to you just immediately. But I'm amazed at the number of people who really don't know. Okay, schools, I'm not chiding anybody here because been there, done that, understand. But sometimes school boards really don't even have a flow chart, have no idea who's responsible to who. Let me give you just a little example here. Is your school patron run or is it church run? Because there's an obvious question in this flow chart. Who's the board answerable to? So it's easy to see the principal is answerable to the board, but who's the board answerable to? Well, if it's a patron-run school, well, then the patrons elect them. And so the next time they come along, if Sam has not been a very good board member, well, he's off and somebody else is on. And so there's this responsibility that placed on the board through the patron people who are doing the voting. If it's church-based, well, then the board, here's all kinds of nuances here. The board, maybe the church leaders will say, well, we're going to nominate the board members, but you may vote on them. It's amazing. There's a lot of ways to govern people. in fact, I always tell my students, government's favorite, the nicest way to govern people is just to create enough red tape that they won't do it. That's seriously true. Just create enough red tape. How many times have you stepped up to do something and you saw that mountain of paperwork and you said, forget that, I'm not doing that. Or just make the fee high enough. Well, you can do it, make the taxes high enough. I mean, one of the ways that they really cut down on smoking in the United States is put a tremendous tax, excise tax on cigarettes. It's a controller. It's a way to manage people. I happen to love government. There's some applications here. There's just ways to actually... So the nomination process, for example, here, it makes a difference. Who's nominating these board members? Who's voting on them? And I'm not here to say which way should be best, but a lot of times, communities don't even know. They're not even thinking about, who's responsible for who here? And who actually says so at the end of the day? How is this? Well, your chain of command, your flow charts are the most realistic, down-to-earth, visible, hands-on way of actually seeing how that's supposed to work. And I find it fascinating to actually try to flowchart my church. So who's responsible to who? What's this bishop's responsibility? What's his job description? I don't want to make it into a business, but boy, it sure does help if you know what you're supposed to do and what the expectations are. Been very, very helpful to me to see some of those things. Faces, means, and methods. Now, again, I'm throwing some things at you here that probably I'll bring up later. So I see I'm going to run out of time here fast, so I'll just run through this part fairly rapidly. The reason I put this here is to show that the question of authority is not so easy. Here, there's positional authority, there's ownership authority. So if you wrote a book and you're the author and you did the right thing, well, then you own it, right? And so you have authority over what happens to that book. If you have a patent on a machine, ownership authority. I did it. I made it. God made us, and that's a big thing. Competence authority, here's one that you're going to hear me coming back to. So you might even call this one knowledge. When you walk into a classroom, listen, let's be really fair here. Howard asked me when I started to teach, it was 1978. I promise you, if you'd walked into my classroom in 1978, you'd have said, that guy is not going to make it. So don't hear me here pointing fingers and talking to about people here who are just, you're getting into it and you're trying to learn. But I'll tell you one thing. At the end of the day, a teacher needs to know what he's talking about when he walks in, when he steps up in front of the classroom reasonably well, or he has a strike against his authority right there. It's not... I'm not even talking classroom management. I'm just talking about what he carries with him. That's what I mean here. Personal authority, which I'm talking about tomorrow. Legal, political authority, I've already mentioned. Experience authority. I've done it. Institutional authority, there is such a thing. Parental authority, should have been first, but I put it there. These are faces. And God at the center of this, or God touching all of these, if we understand, if our understanding is correct. The felt reality really is not just one single authority. It's the lens of authority. It's the overlay of authorities that affect their lives and touch their lives. It becomes the felt reality for them. Three strikes against authority that you're going to have to work with. And number one is truth is relative. I'll be coming back to these later on. Our generation, listen, the children walking into your classroom, even if they are from an Amish family, are children who have been affected by a whole culture that has bought into the idea that truth is relative. Okay, I said a culture. I didn't say they did. I didn't say their parents did. But if you're hearing me right, that soaks in. By and by, it becomes something that we find ourselves right up against. Truth is relative. Strike one. Strike two is love equals unlimited tolerance. Oh, I want to wax eloquent right here, but I'm not going to. this is a huge problem. The millennials, and I know many of you are in that group, postmoderns and all that, this is probably the hallmark, is tolerance. And I did tolerance is needed some places. Unlimited tolerance is not the same as love. And should never be thought of as being that. But that one's being foisted on us. It's being shoved on us. And we need to push back against it. And third, the vote trumps the sovereignty of God. And I already spoke to that just a bit. So I'll let it rest at that. And I'll end with ultimate reality. Coming back to Philippians 2:5-11. If there's any statement that would bring together theory, reality, and felt reality, it certainly is the story of Christ, and again, God exalting him. This is a real story in real time, in real history. There was a real man who suffered on a cross, who actually bled and died, who actually was buried. And as Paul says so eloquently, if he did not rise from the dead, then we are most foolish. But if he did rise from the dead, then that is the most powerful reality that we face. Why? Because even as I'm speaking to you, if I understand my Bible, he has been exalted. He looks down upon us from the right hand of God and given all power and all authority. I want to be on his side, don't you? Have a good day.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.